It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. The anniversary of Freddie Gray's death and the violence and uprising that followed have come and gone. The trials of the six police officers indicted in connection with his death have ended without a single conviction. In the July issue of Harper's Magazine, Dr. Lawrence Jackson, who's been a professor of African American Studies and English at Emory University, reflected on his hometown, Baltimore, and the decades of policies and practices that preceded and seeded the riots and uprising last year. The title of his article invokes a phrase that's familiar to anyone who's been in Charm City for a while. It's called The City That Bleeds. Lawrence Jackson joins me in the studio. Welcome home.
Thank you so very much for having me.
So you've been at Emory University for the past several years, but you are, in fact, on your way home, going to be at Hopkins this coming school year.
I'm very excited to be joining the faculty there.
Yeah. So you start the article with your impressions of the trial of Officer William Porter, the first trial that occurred before the first year. It ended in December. And it turns out that you knew some of the people in that courtroom. Others have noted that William Porter and Freddie Gray grew up just a couple of blocks from each other. They were contemporaries. When you came home and you sat in that courtroom, what did you see and what did it bring to mind?
Well, it was pretty remarkable. I mean, again, from the outside or outside of Baltimore, I'm living in Atlanta, Georgia. I've been there since 2002. You know, you sort of anticipated a huge crowd or what have you. And I remarked that the first couple days of the trial, the Porter trial, the largest groups were students from, I think, Park School and a couple of other local high schools. Maybe City College also had groups of students there. And then once they cleared out, you know, sort of after lunch, I mean, it was a really, you know, more journalists than the public. And I wound up about 2:30 sitting behind Freddie Gray's family. I didn't recognize them or know them, but, you know, you could sort of see the intense emotion that was passing through a group of people. And after a little while, they were joined by another relative who sat beside me. And he was sort of, you know, having a little bit of a conversation with them. And the judge, Barry Williams, had, of course, barred, you know, sort of any speaking. And after a while, sheriff's deputies removed the gentleman. And
it was an uncle of Mr. Gray, evidently.
Apparently so, yes, sir. You know, it was just really a very poignant kind of scene because I've always been dismayed, perhaps, that African Americans, their jury service, our jury service, has been slighted, you know, as if we're somehow particularly subjective jurors or incompetent in cases involving elements of race in American criminal justice system. Anyway, I thought that, you know, this was one time where you actually had, you know, sort of black people with a deep investment in the outcome of the trial. So I was sort of, you know, moved by the situation of the man being removed and also perhaps being drawn into the theater there myself and, you know, was very much prepared to put the sheriff's deputies in the role of the villain. And as I was leaving the courtroom, I realized that I knew several of the sheriff's deputies, and not just casually, but that they were actually people I'd gone to elementary school with, junior high school with, played in the band with, gone to church with. And actually people who I had a really close and important connection to. And that drove home for me that there wasn't a great deal of distance between Freddie Gray and William Porter, and I imagine also Cesar Goodson. And, you know, I've been thinking about the guys that I grew up with, the people in my neighborhood, people that I knew who lost their lives in police custody or in encounters with the police. And it definitely was an occasion for not just soul searching, but also deep melancholy and sadness.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. My guest is Dr. Lawrence Jackson, currently on the faculty of Emory University and about to join the faculty of Johns Hopkins University. He's written an article in Harper's Magazine called The City That Bleeds. Interesting that, you know folks on all sides of the ledger here.
Sure.
You in your article in Harper's, you talk about how what happened in April of 2015 was a genuine uprising. Mm. What do you mean by that?
I suppose having maybe some slight familiarity with the corner, maybe just in passing of Pennsylvania North Avenue. I went to church at Lafayette and Arlington Avenue, and then I, you know, grew up on the north side of Mondawmin Mall.
And I live five blocks from Penn and North, so I know what you're talking about.
Sort of go
and many
through,
of our listeners do too.
Okay, we go through the corridor, but from the time I was about 14 years old or so, maybe even younger than that. I mean, I always wondered why there wasn't an ongoing riot there at Penn North. And, you know, obviously I'm a professional academic. I'm supposed to have either a historical long view or some solutions handy. But you talk to young people and they say, well, the day of the riot, that was the day of widespread communal feeling. That's when people stopped their cars and asked, you know, are you all right? Do you have something to eat? Did you get something from, you know, one of these places? Can we give you a lift somewhere? That's extraordinary, and it's very important when we can identify moments when, you know, sort of the social fabric is so torn that this is an example of, you know, sort of group belonging. I think that instead of vilifying young people, trying to make examples of them, you know, looking for scapegoats, bandying around the term about the thugs or the hoodlums and so on and so forth, that we would do better now to redouble our efforts to try to see if we can rescue a generation or participate fully in the lives of a generation of people who could be, you know, some of the state's best citizens, the most dynamic citizens, the people who are coming up with creative solutions for problems that are not just specific to West Baltimore or Penn North, but I mean to the globe.
You didn't quote who it was, but you said someone somewhere figured out that the investment in a place like Camden Yards,
1%.
You generated 1%. All right, that may or may not be true. I don't know, but let's say it is true. Let's assume that it is, right? Is that a bad deal? Because you haven't lost money on this thing. You've made a little profit, and you've got this thing that brings people together. Ostensibly, brings black, white, Korean, Hispanic together. You know, around you know, excitement about the Orioles and stuff. I mean, the cities talk about the city leadership, both black and white city leadership across the country talks about that dimension of morale and that dimension of you know, city pride. So, because it shouldn't be an either-or thing. It shouldn't be, oh, we're going to invest in Camden Yards, which means we're not going to invest on West North Avenue.
Yeah, I just would be a strong detractor against spectacle sports and the construction of the mega stadiums and the mega athletic spectacles. I mean, baseball arguably is a little bit different, but then baseball also has in the modern era, or certainly for the last 25 years, I mean, they have sort of such poor racial politics. I mean, you know, it has become the lily white sport. I mean, almost
certainly is in the stands.
Yeah,
well, and on the field too. No, but in the stands, it certainly is. Yeah.
All of them in the stands, you know, really do wind up reflecting who can afford to go. But other kinds of investments, I think, would make more sense and would help again the citizens of Baltimore.
All right. Well, Lawrence Jackson, great to meet you and welcome back home. Glad you're going to be at Hopkins and look forward to talking to you again in the future.
Thank you, Tom.
Dr. Lawrence Jackson, he's about to join the faculty of Johns Hopkins University here in Baltimore after several years teaching at Emory University in Atlanta. His essay about Baltimore appeared in the July issue of Harper's Magazine. We've got a link to the piece on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. That's it for us today. Coming up Wednesday, a reporter's notebook on the complex dynamics of the Port Covington Project with Melody Simmons of the Baltimore Business Journal and Natalie Sherman of the Baltimore Sun. Till then, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for listening. Garrison Keillor's up next with the Writer's Almanac. Have a great day.